Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Improving Outcomes with First-Line Endocrine-Based Therapy for Patients with Hormone Receptor-Positive, HER2-Negative Metastatic Breast Cancer. We have a great faculty today for this webinar, Professor Francois Clément Bidard from the Institut Curie in the Versailles University in Paris, and Dr. Kevin Kalinske from the Emory University School of Medicine, the director of the Glenn Family Breast Center and the Winship Cancer Institute of Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. Today we're here to talk about first-line therapy, specifically endocrine-based therapy of patients with metastatic breast cancer, and particularly new trials that are trying to improve outcomes for these patients. As always, we will be talking about the use of non-FDA-approved agents and regimens, so check out the package insert for more information. Here's where we're heading today. We're really going to focus our thoughts and attention today on two presentations, one from each of the faculty. Module 1, Kevin will do a presentation, and Module 2, Francois. But we're going to start out with a little bit of an introduction. I want to explain my garb here today and why I'm wearing what I am wearing. Maybe some of you who are football fans will know. But Francois, I know you're maybe not so familiar with American football, but of course here in the United States, that's a big topic. And Saturday night was a very special night for us here in Miami, Florida, because the University of Miami, which I actually joined the faculty of, believe it or not, in 1977 with Dr. Chuck Vogel as my breast cancer mentor. I really focused on breast cancer when I went into really oncology underneath him. And, you know, always followed the football team. I was watching the game Saturday night. And, you know, Francois, this is kind of like, imagine you're down 5 goals. They were down 25 points in the game. No way they could ever succeed. No way they could ever win, and yet they did. This guy, the guy who wore this, was their leader, and somehow they managed to come away with a victory. And it just made me think a little bit about, you know, facing impossible odds, which is, of course, sort of the beginning of the topic here tonight. When you think about first-line therapy of metastatic breast cancer in general, whether it's ER positive or not, usually we're thinking about a situation that's not curable. But it also made me think a little bit, Kevin, about the fact I was thinking about my mentor in breast cancer, Chuck Vogel. And he always told me, you know, there are these patients with the ER-positive disease, sometimes others, where you can just kind of keep them going, you know, maybe they'll progress, but they may die of something else, you know, 5-10 years later. And actually, we actually started our company by producing a video called Hormonal Therapy for the 1980s. Where we interviewed a bunch of women who were receiving, you know, I don't know if you ever heard of aminoglutethamide, but one of them was getting that, halotestin, et cetera. And I just wanted to start before we kind of dive into the fascinating data that you both are going to talk about, trying to improve the outcomes of these women. Of course, we've come so far in understanding the mechanisms involved here, and now we're going to get deeply into that. You know, just this idea of confronting the first line, what we're talking about here today, a patient and her physician confronting metastatic breast cancer in the first line, a situation that, you know, according to the textbooks, Kevin, is not curable, and yet somehow there are some people who manage to survive and maybe even die of something else. Any comments on that experience, any patients you've had that you think about in that regard as you maybe look toward a future with these new trials that's really going to develop some other alternatives? What it's like to take care of a patient who can survive so long with such a devastating situation, and you know, what your thoughts are about maybe the biology, about why you see these extraordinary responders in breast cancer sometime.
Yeah, Neil, first of all, thank you for having us. I also feel like I would be remiss by not talking about the Vanderbilt Alabama game, where also our pharmacist in clinic today, like, just came back. She's an Alabama fan. I think she's still like in a fetal position, but that's another good example. You know, I think
absolutely.
That, you know, ultimately, We absolutely see some patients who are, you know, on frontline therapy for some time. I can think of examples in all the different disease subtypes that we see, you know, these patients with hormone receptor positive HER2 negative disease who are on endocrine therapy and a CDK4/6 inhibitor. I have a patient who had, you know, just breast disease and then some metastatic lymph node disease who was on this eribulin pembrolizumab trial and then subsequently stopped all of her therapy. And then same for HER2 positive disease, where we even saw in the Cleopatra study that there are patients who have HER2 positive disease. And, you know, even years out, there's a subgroup of patients who are still responding. And I think the toughest conversation is, you know, one, we're excited and happy when we see this. And then there's the question of, okay, well, can I stop? You know, I understand that on my scans, I may have microscopic, you know, disease that's just not being picked up, but do I really need to remain on this therapy? And that's the kind of difficult situation where sometimes we say, well, we don't want to fix what's not broken, but also I don't want to be over-treating you. And that's where it gets tricky with these long-term responders, but we absolutely see it. And, you know, still to understand the biology remains an outstanding question in each of those subtypes, I would say.
So, Francois, you know, another phenomenon that you see in breast cancer that, again, I just can't comprehend, I know it's been out there forever, is delayed recurrence. You know, why do you see somebody go 7 to 8 years and then develop metastatic disease and die? Any thoughts about what, you know, what it is that's going on biologically in these patients who respond well? What's going on in these people who, you know, relapse late?
Yeah, that's something that is kind of specific to breast cancer and mostly to HR plus breast cancer. So this kind of super long dormancy. So there's a lot of biology we don't understand, and there's a lot of explanation we cannot give to our patient, because they will ask at some point, you know, why did I relapse? And, you know, why is it happening 20 years after I've been cured for my early breast cancer? So that's something that is really not understood. Maybe it's related to the, you know, immune system and, you know, immune system history. Whether the immune system gets exhausted by something else, honestly, we don't know. The good thing is that often these late recurrences have somehow good prognosis. So if you had, like, say, the age at the initial diagnosis, and then you had 20 years, like, for the late recurrence, and if you had the power and the long PFS we can achieve with our treatment, let's say it's... these patients are more likely to die from something else than their breast cancer. And I think that's our purpose and our goal as oncologists is to, let's say, treat them for as long as we can and to maintain their quality of life. But hoping that even if we cannot cure them, you know, maybe that they will get they would get old enough to maybe die from something else. And I think that in that case, we've done our job.
Yeah, we just did a think tank on CML. We spent 3 hours talking about CML, and that's always been our model for, you know, curing people at least functionally. Anyhow, let's dive deeper into what we can do to make more patients live longer or maybe even get cured. This is kind of a summary of the current status of the use of hormonal therapy in the first and second line. We'll get into a lot of these things. But I just got to ask one thing before we get started, Kevin. We asked the audience a question about that I was curious what your thoughts are in terms of tolerability. Obviously, we're going to get into how we can improve what we have right now, Kevin. But I'm curious how you see tolerability of CDK inhibitors right now. I kind of we did a program at ASCO where we showed a video of a doc in practice saying, you know, I give the older patients, you know, age 75, 80, 85, I give them the option of taking palbo because I think it's better tolerated. And then I've talked to investigators who say, well, you know, ribo is just as well tolerated as palbo, and of course it has a survival advantage. We asked the audience what they thought about the tolerability of whether they thought ribo and palbo were equally tolerable, you know, and for example in an older patient. Just kind of curious, Kevin, you have a 80, 82 year old patient. Will you bring up, do you always turn to ribo, or you bring up a palbo? Would you bring it up in a younger patient? Do you think it's better tolerated, better quality of life than ribo?
I do. I do think it's the easiest to tolerate of the CDK4/6 inhibitors. And if I had an 82-year-old patient, I would and have discussed palbociclib as the frontline agent for those patients. I would say in younger patients, especially premenopausal patients, but in general, I would say ribociclib is my CDK4/6 inhibitor of choice. I think that there's some exceptions where there are drug-drug interactions that I'm worried about with giving ribociclib. I have seen, significant liver function abnormalities with ribociclib, abemaciclib, of course, the gastrointestinal issues. The other thing that I will say is that there's an ASCO sponsor pragmatic study that is about to open. I think it's called like the CDK dosing study, which is looking at older patients, meaning greater than or equal to 65. And then patients will either start at the standard dose or a lower dose and ramp up, ultimately seeing if there are any differences in terms of, adherence and outcome.
So curious about your thoughts on this, Francois. I was in Kevin's camp. Actually, we polled the audience, and the most common answer is Kevin's answer. However, the second most common answer from the audience was that actually palbo and ribo are about the same. And I was kind of shocked because I did a program with a very prominent investigator recently, and she said, "Nah, I think ribo and palbo are about equal in terms of quality of life, etc." I see palbo being combined with stuff, including SERDs. So what do you think, Francois, do you think palbo is better quality of life or about the same as ribo, particularly in older people?
Well, so to be honest, I think that's, for most patients, it would be the same. But we are afraid by several stuff, especially in terms of co-medications and EKG to be performed. And so with ribo. And also our staff to be also, as is really has been used to use palbo and to see patients on palbo, and they know how to dose reduce and so on. So let's say, I would say that it's I would call it a safer environment for an elderly patient to be put on palbo, because I know that everyone at my hospital, from the nurses to the residents, know to manage palbociclib and what to expect and what to look for, and that may not be fully the case with ribo, and it tends to commit in the elderly population. So I know that my oncogeriatricist at my site are really prescribing palbociclib most often. It's not exclusive, and ribo could be well tolerated, but still we have kind of transaminitis and maybe a slightly more concern about the safety there, even though there is no strong data to suggesting a strong difference in tolerability. But because of the habits, and because palbo is apparently working, and because we don't, what is the relevance of 5-year overall survival in an elderly population, that has a lot of co-medication, comorbidities, and so on. What we just want is to stabilize the disease for the next couple of years. So palbo is probably doing a great job in that.
One of our themes in almost every program we do is getting the patient involved if they want to. And certainly in situations like this, if a patient wants to have a voice, they certainly, I think, should. All right, let's dive a little bit into the data. And I was noticing that your director of the Glenn Family Breast Center, Kevin, I actually started, I think, the first breast center for Inogen people in the United States at the University of Miami. It still exists, University of Miami Jackson Memorial Hospital, really a great opportunity here in Dade County. But let's go through the data, looking at the issue of how the mechanisms of resistance that we see in hormonal therapy and where SERDs fit in. Kevin?
Great. All right. So, we've recognized that endocrine resistance can be associated with a worse prognosis in hormone receptor positive disease. And so what I'm showing you in this slide is that these are patient level data. These are from 4 randomized clinical trials. And you can see just, the median overall survival comparing those that have endocrine resistant disease compared to those who have endocrine sensitive disease. And, you know, as per the conversation that we were really just having, in terms of the CDK4/6 inhibitor trials, you know, we have approval for three CDK4/6 inhibitors, palbociclib, ribociclib, and abemaciclib, where we see a progression-free survival hazard ratio that is similar across the trials, but overall survival some differences, also recognizing that not all of the studies were powered to look at overall survival. So when we think about how tumors behave after CDK4/6 inhibition, it's important for us to think about some of the resistance mechanisms that can exist. And these are some data from the MSK group where, you know, looking at tumors before and after CDK4/6 inhibitor, you can see an increased rate of ESR1 mutations, which is an adaptive resistance mechanism that we'll be spending a lot of this hour talking about, and also the development of, for instance, RB1 truncating mutations. So ESR1 mutations, make those agents that we have, like aromatase inhibitors, not effective. And we think about agents such as selective estrogen receptor downregulators and some novel endocrine therapies being mechanisms or ways for us to overcome this resistance. I imagine that Francois will also talk a bit about this, but when we think about the prevalence of ESR1 mutations for patients when they're starting before they start their first-line endocrine therapy in the metastatic setting, that rate of ESR1 mutations is about 5%. But then after frontline therapy, when we look in the second, third line, it's somewhere between 30 to 40% of patients have ESR1 mutations. And we'd seen historical data where, and this is what really helped drive the clinical utility of checking for ESR1 mutations. So, of course, the approval of elacestrant also drove this as well, where we saw that patients in the SOPHIA and EFFECT trial, if they were randomly assigned to XMS stain and they had an ESR1 mutation, they did not really seem to respond as opposed to the patients who received fulvestrant, who even if they have ESR1 mutations may respond to single agent fulvestrant. So if we look at the different trials that we have, this is just a table that's looking at various targeted therapies in various settings. Again, just to really make the point that ESR1 mutations frontline, before patients start their endocrine therapy in the first line setting, is low, about 5% or less. But once you start getting post CDK4/6 inhibition, that starts to increase. This is a slide that is just highlighting the fact that not all ESR1 mutations, hotspot mutations, are the same. And there are some data that, for instance, those with Y537S mutations, these are some in vivo activity, that fulvestrant may not be as active as what we see with some of the other ESR1 mutations. And it's just really asking the question, at some point, if we have additional SERDs approved, will we get to a setting where, okay, you have a D53G mutation, would you think about getting this SERD? If you have a Y537S mutation, this, or, even the question of, whether we'll be seeing oral SERDs having beneficial activity regardless of the presence of ESR1 mutations, including those who are ESR1 wild type. So I just spent some time talking about SERDs, but there are other novel endocrine therapies for us to be thinking about. There are additional SERMs that are in development, like, for instance, lasofoxifene. They're complete estrogen receptor antagonists, like palazestrant. There are PROTACs, such as the ARV agent, and then there's SERCAs as well. But the only approved oral SERD at this time is elacestrant. And this is also a study that Francois knows very well, which is a study, the EMERALD trial, which is essentially looked at patients who had tumors that had progressed on or after first or second line endocrine therapy, one of which was given in combination with a CDK4/6 inhibitor. Patients were allowed to have at least one line of chemotherapy, and patients were randomly assigned to single agent fulvestrant versus investigator choice standard of care therapy, including fulvestrant. And it were dual primary endpoints where they looked at progression-free survival in all patients, as well as those who have ESR1 mutants. And it is worth noting that in terms of progression-free survival, that this was based upon blinded independent central review. That was the primary endpoint. So these are some data that I actually think are clinically relevant that were recently reported in Clinical Cancer Research, which looked at how long were patients on their prior CDK4/6 inhibitor, really looking at this as a surrogate of endocrine sensitivity. And you can see that for those patients who were on their prior CDK4/6 inhibitor for at least 12 months, that's when we start to see a real delta in terms of the benefit of elacestrant, where in this particular case, it's a median PFS of 8 months compared to about 2 months for standard of care hormonal therapy and a hazard ratio of 0.4. SERDs are being evaluated in various settings. They're being evaluated in the metastatic setting. They're being evaluated in the operable setting. I'm only highlighting here one study, which is the Pioneera study, which is looking at this endocrine-resistant population. So for patients who have tumors that progressed on or quickly within 12 months or so of completing their adjuvant endocrine therapy, which is looking at giving fulvestrant CDK4/6 inhibitor versus giredestrant CDK4/6 inhibitor.
So before you go on, Kevin, just a couple of questions. First, to come back to Francois, and thinking a little bit about this last slide that you went through showing the other SERDs that are in development. One of the things that I've been hearing, Francois, is that some of these have SERM-like qualities, elacestrant in particular, I've heard that, as opposed to being a pure SERD. Is that true? And what does it mean? Is it an advantage to have a pure compound? And at this point, with indirect comparisons, can you differentiate anything in terms of efficacy with these agents?
Well, that's a good question. So I think that at a preclinical level, like in vitro level, there are some, stimulation of the estrogen receptors that could be achieved by some of these compounds. So let's say more SERM-like compound. So more a modulator than a degrader. And elacestrant is, one of them at the in vitro level. But, in the clinics, does it matter? We don't know exactly at the moment. Because there is no side effect, at the uterine level or even at the bone level. So we don't know really if it matters, in our patients. It could matter in terms of side effects, because the two agents that are most known to be, pure SERDs, which are camizestrant and giredestrant, have kind of common side effects, lower heartbeat, and also some, vision blurring, blood vision. So it could be that there is a kind of class effect between the pure SERD versus the SERM SERD. But in terms of side effect or in terms of toxicity, I don't see much of a difference. So not very relevant for me in the clinics.
So Kevin, I'm curious also in terms of some of the strategies, and Francois is going to talk a little bit about this, but one of these agents, camizestrant, we're going to talk about the phase 3 study. But first of all, it was looked at in the SERENA-2 phase 2 study compared to fulvestrant. One of the things that I noticed is as we started to treat people with fulvestrant after CDK, it looked like they weren't getting as much benefit as before CDK. But in any event, maybe that is something that I've heard, maybe that has to do with the dose, et cetera. Any thoughts about what we learned, though, from the SERENA-2 study, Kevin?
Yeah, from SERENA-2, I think one saw that, it was a smattering, as you mentioned, where some patients had prior CDK4/6 inhibition, others did not. I think we saw that there was some activity with camizestrant, and it was really a proof of principle that we should be evaluating this in a larger trial. I also think that, it's important to note that the time of response post CDK4/6 is less, right? And that is something that we've seen with other phase 3 randomized trials. And so, when interpreting these data, it's just important to note that there is kind of a mixed population. So if you look at those patients who didn't get prior CDK4/6 inhibition, they seem to do better in both of the arms.
So I'm curious also, Francois, and again, here's some more data we were talking about. You were just mentioning prior CDK. versus, again, versus the no prior CDK. It looked like without prior CDK, with prior CDK, they had a greater hazard rate there. Also looking at whether they benefited by ESR1, and it looks like most of the benefit seems to be in is ESR1 patients. Do you agree with that, Francois?
Yeah, fully agree. So that's something that we have seen with many agents. We have seen it with elacestrant in Emerald, and we are seeing it now with camizestrant in Serena 2. So these data are showing that the new agents, such as camizestrant, are more active than the old agent fulvestrant. So in patients with ESR1 mutations, and apparently in patients without ESR1 mutations, they are equally active than fulvestrant. So overall, if you mix together the two populations, the new drugs are the old drugs, next generation SERDs, are more active, but could be slightly more active. But if you divide by ESR1 status, then you have a strong activity in the ESR1 mutated subgroup. Yes.
And we're going to talk about a fascinating trial. Actually, I've discussed this trial not this one here, but this one and the one we're going to talk about, looking at people who flip to ESR1 while they're getting therapy with investigators outside of breast cancer are very fascinated. But just kind of curious, Kevin, this is the Serena 4 Phase 3 ongoing study, first-line therapy metastatic disease. Pretty straightforward. Again, Palbo being the CDK that it's combined with, but either Cami or anastrozole. Just kind of curious, what do you think we're going to see quality of life-wise or interruption of therapy-wise, Kevin?
My guess would be that it will favor those patients who receive Cami. I think, Francois had mentioned this. With Cami, we can see that photopsia, right, where patients feel like, you know, sometimes they have a little bit of a blurry vision, but that goes away. As we know, with the aromatase inhibitors, there's a notable, like sizable population that have, toxicity like arthralgias, et cetera. And it's nice to have potential agents that don't cause this, because adherence can be challenging, especially in the early stage setting. And so, we'll see how it looks, in a randomized phase 3 trial, but I think ultimately quality of life will be better.
So I'm going to let you go back to your presentation and pick up with this slide here from the ASCO rapid recommendation. I remember we had Hal Burstein, who was, I think, in charge of this, one of our meetings, I think, at ASCO, and he was telling us what a headache it was to try to figure this whole thing out, go through all the data, and that hormonal therapy was getting too complicated to do guidelines on anymore. But anyhow, they did come up with some pretty important practical recommendations. Kevin, can you continue?
Yeah, for sure. And, ASCO, after their approval of agents, like they're doing these rapid recommendations really to help establish these guidelines. And so I just wanted to highlight the point that, it is recommended that for patients, with hormone receptor positive HER2 negative disease that have tumors that have progressed on endocrine therapy with or without a CDK4/6 inhibitor, that we are doing ESR1 mutation testing. And part of the debate that we had within the committee was how to frame the conversation about the kind of testing that we should be doing. And, ultimately we landed on that one should be doing blood-based ctDNA, just given that it's, there's greater sensitivity, but that if you're seeing wild type or you're not detecting anything, then it may be worth, collecting tumor and then seeing whether you can identify mutations. This may seem just a little bit off topic, but I felt like it was important for us to mention in that, ANAVO 120 is a study that's looking in this endocrine resistant population. So I'm going to shift gears for just a moment, because I'm really talking about patients, again, hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative disease that have PI3K mutations. And this is a patient population similar to what I was describing for Pionera, but this is just for patients with PI3K mutations, where patients had measurable disease and then they were randomly assigned, Neil, as you had mentioned, to fulvestrant palbo versus the triplet of fulvestrant palbo plus inavolisib, which is given once a day. It's a PI3K inhibitor. It's not yet approved, though I suspect it will be coming to a clinic near us soon. And the reason I really brought this up is look at the median PFS that we see for patients who are getting, you know, doublet therapy of palbo plus fulvestrant, right? It's about 7 months. Compared to the triplet, where it's about 15 months, and the hazard ratio is 0.43, and we've seen updated data. We're waiting for the paper to be published. But I do think that this will be clinically impactful for those patients who have PI3K mutations with endocrine-resistant disease. And so really my general take home is that we have novel endocrine therapies. You know, we have our oral, the first oral SERD, elacestrant, but I really suspect that these agents and other novel endocrine therapies will continue to have an important role in hormone receptor positive metastatic disease, as well as potentially in early stage disease as well.
So, Kevin, you had a case, kind of a typical case, but I think a good one just to bring up to kind of get in front of us in terms of where we are right now with the typical use of a SERD. Maybe you can just present what happened with this 42-year-old woman.
For sure. So this is a 42-year-old woman, had right invasive ductal carcinoma, is grade 2, hormone receptor positive, strongly hormone receptor positive, quote-unquote HER2 low. She had not had prior breast imaging. It was T3N2. She had staging scans, which showed bone and lung mets. She had a lung biopsy, confirmed metastatic disease. She was having some back pain. Excellent performance status, does not have a hereditary mutation, and a patient underwent a THBSO. As I'd already kind of alluded to, you know, based upon the Mona Lisa 7 data, she went on to get an AI and ribociclib. She was on this for around 3 years or so. She had a tumor that had progressed. She had a ctDNA that was checked. She had an ESR1 mutation, Y537S. And, you know, these are things that when we see patients that we consider for them, you know, whether, well, one, she does not have a alteration in the PI3K pathway. So agents like alpelisib or capivasertib are not one that we would think about, you know, giving her, whether we should give her an ADC like trastuzumab deruxtecan, you know, based upon the DESTINY-Breast06 data that we have seen, or other chemotherapy or ADCs, or whether we should remain with endocrine therapy, such as giving elacestrant. And also we have data about switching the endocrine therapy backbone and continuing a CDK4/6 inhibitor plus the maintain, per the maintain or post-monarch data. So we have several options. It's just a question of how we should be best sequencing these options.
So I think people probably wouldn't be surprised that this lady ended up on elacestrant, is doing well. And so any tolerability issues she's had?
No. Mm-mm. I mean, I will say my experience in clinic, this agent is well-tolerated.
So, Francois, we actually found out that we're presenting three posters at San Antonio, and one of them is a survey we did of not only investigators but also elite general medical oncologists, and one of the most about how they manage second-line hormonal therapy. And one of the most interesting things we found is what happens if you take this same case and add a PIK3 mutation. And I was really curious what the investigators are going to say and what the docs in practice were going to say. I'm going to tell you what we're going to report in our, I guess it should be embargoed or something, but anyhow, I'll tell you what we saw in our survey, but I'm just kind of curious, how do you handle these double mutated patients?
Well, let's say I'm going to hide behind my French environment, which is we don't have access to alpelisib in France currently. And also we're waiting for to getting access for to capivasertib. So at the moment, it will be fulvestrant plus everolimus, or we could still consider elacestrant as single agent. So depending on the first line, here the first line was long enough to consider elacestrant single agent. That would be my choice. And if I were in the US, my experience with alpelisib is not so good. I with long PFS in first line, I would still believe in ESR1 or at least go for elacestrant or a SERD. Fulvestrant or one of the new SERD, maybe in combination with something else, fulvestrant everolimus. And, you know, fulvestrant alpelisib could be good because it's targeting both ESR1 and PIK3CA, but still the toxicity of alpelisib for me is a concern.
So again, assuming all available options, which they sort of are in the United States, Kevin, how do you think through this situation? Do you always go with the same, or do you sort of tailor it to the situation? How do you approach it? A lot of people say, well, elacestrant is going to be better tolerated, but how do you approach it?
Yeah, I mean, when I answer this question, I think about when I was a trainee and my attending would say, oh, like, it really depends on the situation. I thought, well, that's not really, like, that's not an answer. But that's actually what I would do. Where if I had a patient who had indolent, slow-growing bone mets, I feel like elacestrant is absolutely appropriate. If I have a patient who I'm really concerned about the cadence, like that, well, we would have known that the cadence was relatively slow, but if now the patient has significant visceral disease or something where I feel like I need a little bit more activity than something that's single agent, I think as Francois had mentioned, fulvestrant, capivasertib, fulvestrant, everolimus is a good option. The other option is something like fulvestrant plus abemaciclib for the postMONARCH. Particularly if I'm concerned about somebody who may not be able to tolerate getting capivasertib, you know, somebody who has uncontrolled diabetes, for instance.
So, you know, it's like when we do these surveys, we always learn from the surveys and then we have to change it for the next time. But what we saw here, because we just asked people what they did, it was like 50-50. Investigators, and we didn't realize that you got to like shade it in terms of the situation. And actually, also the general medical oncologist, same thing, 50-50. So as you said, you know, really a lot of flexibility in this situation, as there often is in breast cancer. All right, let's move on now and really start to get into some of the strategies that we're looking at to improve long-term outcomes, particularly this fascinating strategy. But again, I talk about this trial in particular using CAMI in this situation where people develop ESR1 mutations to investigators in other tumor types, just as an example of how, you know, looking at resistance early, and they're fascinated by it. So you guys are like in the lead from what I can tell in oncology and looking at this. But Francois, we asked you to sort of explore sort of what's behind all this.
Yes, thank you. So it's always a pleasure. And I think that breast cancer has led most of innovation in oncology. So it's very good for us to continue with that. So here it's about a new strategy, which is to definitely to target ESR1 mutation as soon as they appear. So it's really important to understand the kinetics and when these mutations appear in the course of the disease and how to target them. So I'll start with the context, the first line. And so we are very happy with our current first line with either palbociclib, ribociclib, abemaciclib, and we discussed, you know, how to choose between the two. But here the question is really how to extend this first line. And the issue with this first line, if you look at the curve, is that none of this curve has a plateau, so which means all patients will eventually progress. And this disease progression, we know that afterwards there is a shortened, and we touched on this also, a shortened PFS in second line. So this is an example with fulvestrant. Fulvestrant, remember, it was 11 months in SOLAR in patients that were not pretreated with CDK4/6, but in BELIEVE. With patients that were CDK4/6 pretreated, the median PFS on alpelisib was just cut by half. So that's, let's say, once a patient is progressing on CDK4/6 inhibitors, it's very important to keep in mind that the next line are much shorter. So these are other examples of the current PFS we are getting with contemporary trial run in the post CDK4/6 setting, elacestrant 3.8 months, fulvestrant plus abemaciclib 6 months, and fulvestrant capivasertib 7.3 months. I think these median PFS are fine, but they are not very satisfactory. You know, the patients, they had like 24 months or even longer PFS in first line, and then they will deal with very short PFS in second line. So again, we need to do a bit better. We need to increase the time on the first line, because when the patient progress on CDK4/6, then, you know, we are facing a lot of troubles. So we need to understand the acquired resistance mechanism to CDK4/6 inhibitors plus AI to understand really how these resistances are happening and how to tackle this resistance. And when it comes to, resistance to CDK4/6 inhibitor. So we have a combination in first line. We have the AI and we have CDK4/6 inhibitors. We don't know much about the resistance mechanism, but the one we know are rare and we cannot target them. So we could, let's say, forget about this resistance mechanism for the moment, but we could focus on something that is very important, which are these ESR1 mutation. And as shown on the scheme here, these resistance mutations are appearing during the first line. So again, if you look at the first line, so before starting the first line, less than 5% of patients display an ESR1 mutation. And when there is a disease progression under AI, given at the metastatic stage, up to 40% of patients have an ESR1 mutation detected. So these mutations are appearing in between during the first line. And what is interesting is that if you detect an ESR1 mutation that is rising and appearing in the blood, at that time, the tumor may still be sensitive to the CDK4/6 inhibition. It is only a resistance that is happening, that is developing and resisting to the AI partner, to the endocrine therapy partner, but the CDK4/6 inhibitor may still be efficient. So the idea is to use a drug that could be target ESR1, an endocrine therapy, and we have one, which is fulvestrant. And we know, and Kevin has shown, that we have data showing that fulvestrant is efficient in ESR1 mutant patient, even though the PFS that is displayed here with plasma match and Emerald, as you see, fulvestrant is not a very efficient drug, not a very potent drug in patients when it is given after disease progression. With that in mind, so we have these rising ESR1 mutations that are appearing during the first line. And what we have done in PADA1, so it's an academic proof of concept trial, so that was run in France. So with about 1,000 patients, these patients went on AI plus palbociclib as first line treatment. And we monitored in these 1,000 patients the appearance of ESR1 mutation. So at the very beginning, that's very few patients were at an ESR1 mutation, but we knew we would intercept and we would detect this rising ESR1 mutation in the blood. And patients with a detected rising ESR1 mutation in their blood without disease progression were then randomized. They have a molecular signal of resistance to AI. So we randomize them between the usual strategy, which is not to take into account the signals, so patients continue the same treatment, or we just did a small switch, which is switching the endocrine therapy partner from AI, apparently not working anymore, to fulvestrant, which is known to be more active on ESR1 mutation. So it's a small change in the endocrine therapy partner, but we are targeting the resistance mechanism to the endocrine therapy while maintaining the CDK4/6 inhibition. So again, the idea was to delay disease progression and also to kind of optimal use of SERDs as a targeted therapy against ESR1 mutations. And the question was, is it feasible? Is it acceptable by patients in terms of results? So we show it is feasible and it is well accepted by patients. But in terms of results, what we got is that with the most recent PFS data, we got a delta with between the two arms of more than about 7 months, which is much longer than what you can get with fulvestrant used after disease progression. So that I think this kind of delta has really drove the attention to PADA1 because it is suggestive of a benefit of using fulvestrant as soon ESR1 mutation appear in the blood. We had also like kind of carryover effect, let's say in terms of PFS2, time to the second tumor progression from randomization, with a clear benefit in favor of the switch to fulvestrant. In terms of safety, the beauty of this strategy is that it is just a small switch. Patients were maintained on their CDK4/6 inhibitors, so we had no toxicity, with no significant toxicity. It's just a switch from an oral drug, AI, to an intramuscularly delivered drug, fulvestrant. So nothing much happened to our randomized patients. And so we had a very good benefit in front of this very low toxicity profile.
So just to quickly go to Kevin, any thoughts about this strategy and how and what you've heard up to this point in the talk and what your thoughts are about the about it?
Yeah, I mean, I believe I've said this directly to Francois, but I will say this publicly. Like, I think that this was a study that we'll look back and say was a study before its time, right? Because I think that this is a... it's a study and a strategy that could really make sense. I think that, you know, as Francois knows, I think a lot of people are waiting for the results of SERENA-6 to really help confirm in a larger study with a newer SERD, you know, whether we're seeing the same sort of effect for PFS and then ultimately also for PFS2. But I do think that, you know, Francois got ahead of the curve by doing this, and you know, this I have a strong. If I were a betting person, I would say that we will see this sort of benefit in SERENA-6.
Well, I like that kind of estimation there. So this is the SERENA-6 phase 3 trial. This may be how we're going to be treating breast cancer in the near future. But can you talk a little bit about the background in terms of how this was put together and the specific design, Francois?
Yes, sure. So SERENA-6, again, PADA-1 was an academic proof of concept trial, a small trial run in France. Here, SERENA-6, it's really like the next level. First, it's a global phase 3 trial. It is registrational, and it is registrational for camizestrant. And camizestrant, as we discussed earlier on, is more active than fulvestrant on ESR1 mutation. So we expect a signal of activity that could maybe exceed the signal of activity we've seen in PADA-1. So it's a very promising drug when it comes to targeting ESR1 and like really an interesting strategy. So what is doing SERENA-6 is the same idea of PADA-1 is, like say, screening and monitoring the appearance of ESR1 mutation while patients are being treated with AI and any CDK4/6, so palbociclib or ABEMA or RIBO, this patient could enter SERENA-6, get the ctDNA screening that was done every 3 months in SERENA-6, and in the case of a rising ESR1 mutation, exactly the same concept as in PADA-1, then patients were randomized again between staying on the same treatment, and we don't pay attention to the biomarker, or we switch the endocrine therapy to camizestrant, which is a very potent drug, and the CDK4/6 inhibitor partner was maintained, so unchanged, same dose, same drug. So it's really like a switch of the endocrine therapy when you see that AI is not working anymore. So in terms of enrollment, so the study has been enrollment has been completed, and what is interesting is that we will have the readout probably in 2025, and you know, the potential benefit we may document, we have maybe touched on with PADA-1, but that we may document with SERENA-6 here, like really maximizing the SERD efficacy. And we expect to really show that the benefit is higher or is really strong in with the switch when you see this mutation popping up in the blood. And why is that? It could be like, you know, it could be related to the fact of early targeting resistance subclone where there are still a minority in the tumor could be a more efficient strategy. And again, the idea is to maximize. We are seeing these patients are developing a resistance to the endocrine therapy partner, so we can keep this patient on CDK4/6 and we could maximize the length of the first line, so giving more months and more time to our patients.
So we're going to go on in a second and have Francois present this case, as we've got a lot of questions for Kevin to address. But just kind of curious, we're getting a lot of people asking questions in the chat room about how often in the trial they check for ESR1 mutations, Kevin. But just kind of curious, do you see any rationale for doc right now in practice to look for this? Would that make them more suspicious of an early recurrence, or any reason, any rationale for somebody to be looking at it before we see the data?
No, I don't think so. Not until we see SERENA-6. I mean, I think that there's a lot of interest just in terms of, really, we utilize ctDNA now for the detection of mutations. Like, this is asking about the development and monitoring for the detection of mutations. And I think that we will get there, but I think it will depend upon the results of SERENA-6. And, you know, Francois alluded to this, and I agree, this was PADA-1 was a smaller study. The confirmatory study is SERENA-6.
So, and again, one other question, Kevin, what are we looking for in order to make a change in practice, PFS, survival? What are you thinking?
How much time do we have left? I think that, you know, the primary endpoint is PFS, and I believe, and Francois, correct me if I'm wrong, but the collection is every 3 months, just looking for ESR1 mutations. And so, you know, the study, I suspect, will read out once we see PFS. I do think that there will continue to be an interest in terms of PFS2. And then we'll see if there's an overall survival advantage. And Francois, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm not sure that the study is powered to look at overall survival. Please correct me if I'm wrong. But I do think that the community will be very interested in knowing what PFS2 will look like, which, just to make sure we're on the same page, that's the time for randomization to the time of the second progression.
Yes, you're right.
So right, we actually have a cool case. We have a cool case in the chat room from Kathleen. I hope we can get to it. A 73-year-old woman with a 15-year history of stable oligometastatic disease who now sounds like she's progressing. But let's go with Francois' case first, a 69-year-old lady. What happened with her?
So for the sake of time, I'm going to just like recap what is on the slide. So basically, a patient stage 4 de novo, breast cancer, ER positive, put on letrozole and ribociclib. And treatment is well tolerated, and the patient is coming back to your clinic. Like, it's an interactive case. So it's a patient is coming back to your clinic after 3 months on treatment, and she's tolerating well letro and ribo. So at that time, I imagine you are also reviewing the results of tests that you have ordered. Somatic NGS testing showing no BRCA mutation in germline, but PIK3CA mutation in the breast tumor, and there was no ESR1 mutation detected. First question, which is very easy, is, you know, should we expect to find an ESR1 mutation in the tumor tissue? And again, the biopsy was performed prior to treatment start. And also, you know, in terms of commutation between PIK3CA and ESR1, is there kind of commutation? And, you know, what happens when the patient has a germline BRCA2 mutation? Does it impact the onset of ESR1? So I'm providing some of the answers. First question was related to the, do you expect to find an ESR1 mutation in the tumor tissue? The answer is clearly no. And as we already discussed, it is very important, again, to keep in mind these mutations appear after exposure or during exposure to aromatase inhibitor given for metastatic breast cancer. And we have data in PADA-1, and we looked prior to treatment start, so prior to AI and palbociclib. We described the factors associated with a higher prevalence of ESR1. So we are able to detect ESR1 in about 3% of patients. We have factors that are associated with a statistically increased incidence of ESR1. But if you look at the number, like even 7.1%, the maximal incidence we saw in a defined subgroup. So overall, ESR1 mutations are very rare prior to treatment start and prior to AI exposure in metastatic at the metastatic stage. When it comes to other data outside PADA-1, so this is a study that are reporting data from FMI. So NGS done mostly in the US, and you see both on, you could detect ESR1 on tissue and also on blood, and the percentage that are displayed at the bottom on the slide are increasing alongside with a line of treatment. So again, we are seeing these mutations really emerging during treatment with AI. So the more you test, the more you detect, both in tissue and in blood. But of course, blood is much easier to do when it comes to repeated assessment. When it comes to PIK3CA mutation, there is a no significant mutual exclusion or association. So overall, 15 to 20% of patients are expected to have at some point both the PIK3CA mutation, which is present from the beginning of the tumor, and an acquired ESR1 mutation. So nothing to expect much here. BRCA was the last part of the question. If you have a patient that has a BRCA2 mutation and a metastatic ER-positive breast cancer, what do you expect on AI plus CDK4/6? It has been documented by the MSKCC team, but also we are confirming it in PADA1 that these patients have a shorter PFS on AI plus CDK4/6. But when it comes to ESR1 mutations, the rate of ESR1 mutation is pretty similar in this patient. So the presence of BRCA2 mutation does not prevent the onset of ESR1 mutation. So then the question about, remember, the patient is coming back at your clinics at 3 months, and you are telling the patient about the risk of ESR1 mutations appearing during therapy. And here, Kevin, I ask you about, what are the main talking points, when you are, what would you do? I understand you are not doing it now in your clinics, but what would you do if you had to, you wanted to discuss about, explaining ESR1 and what is, why you need to test, and, what is the purpose of it and what is the meaning of it?
Yeah. I mean, I think the biggest question is whether intervening early is going to make a difference, right? Because we know that the tumor is not going to be as responsive to an aromatase inhibitor-based therapy, while patients are developing ESR1 mutations. And so, I think the clinical quandary, like in real life, I think the clinical quandary would be you check an ESR1 mutation while you're on an AI and CDK4/6 inhibitor, you see an ESR1 mutation, you do scans, you don't see progression. What do you do? And that's where the data we have now would suggest switching to fulvestrant-based treatment. But again, it would be nice to have this in a larger study and, the question about a novel SERD instead of fulvestrant.
So we've kind of run out of our time here. If you want to check out more of the case of the chat room, we have the slides there for you to take a look at, including several slides here at the end with some new trials and new data sets in the adjuvant, as well as in the neoadjuvant setting, also PROTAC studies. But there are a couple questions in the chat room. I just want to run by Kevin real quick. Sohail brings up the issue of a patient who has an ER of 10%. I'm going to ask you, is that ER, what about 5%? Is that ER positive or not? And does the PR affect? A pretty basic question. Mm-hmm. She actually says 10%, PR 40%. Is that ER positive?
Yeah, I mean, technically, based upon ASCO CAP guidelines, and we know that if you have positivity for ER and PR, PR can be an indicator of endocrine therapy response. I tend to worry when I see a patient have low estrogen receptor expression giving endocrine-based therapy in the metastatic setting. However, I have also seen second opinions where they come to me and their provider had done such an approach and patients have had a response. And so it still makes me worried given some of my own anecdotal experience. But the truth is I've seen otherwise too. And I think the question is also like, when was that biopsy? Was that biopsy done in a time that was close to when we're treating?
I mean, you've heard of HER2 low, but I think we ought to be talking a lot more about ER low. I'm not sure, do you give them, they have localized disease, do you give them Keynote 522? So final question back to you, Francois, again from the chat room. Danny wants to know whether you have any concern for lead time bias confounding the PFS assessment with PADA1 or SERENA-6.
Yes, so lead time, it refers to a lot of notions. Most of time, we understand lead time as early diagnosis of metastatic relapse. Here is not the case. Like, patients are already under treatment, so it's just a switch from one to another. And we have the magnitude we've seen with fulvestrant, with adding fulvestrant, so the delta of 6 months is suggesting, like, the real delta between the two arms is suggesting that of an effect that it's much stronger than seen later on. And I've shown you that later on, fulvestrant, single agent, or even combined with CDK4/6, gives you like 2 months or 3 months, which is much shorter than the 6 to 7 months we've seen in Padawan. So that's currently all the data we have. We'll see again. So that's maybe not enough to convince. Again, I understand Padawan was kind of pioneering. We'll see what happens with much broader Tendrec, with Camizestrant and in Serena 6. And so we need to build more data to convince, you know, like these. It's a switch of therapy for the patient, but it's also a switch of management for the doctors. So, of course, we need to provide some strong evidence.
So I want to thank the faculty for working with us today. Thank the audience for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Francois. Thanks, Kevin. Have a good one.
Thank you.